Hello, and welcome back to Book Therapy. This is episode 10, like it's some sort of a milestone. I don't know, 10 sounds like a nice round number. This is Rob Cohen. Like I said, this is Book Therapy, and it's been a long time since we've talked, not for lack of trying. Life sometimes gets in the way, you know how it is, and sometimes trying to get computer time, get a little bit of one-on-one with the microphone can be a little bit challenging, but here we are. Last couple weeks, I have been busy, though. Certainly, I've been doing a lot of reading. We'll get to those books in a few minutes. But on another front, trying to figure out better ways for you to get in contact with me. So I've created a separate Twitter account for Book Therapy. Now it's under Book Therapy 13, Book Therapy, and then the numbers 1 and 3 on Twitter. I also created a separate Facebook page for Book Therapy, and I will try to update the Facebook page and update my Twitter a little bit more often so that you know what's going on with my reading and know what's going on with new episodes. I've been plugging this episode 10 for a couple weeks now, and sorry if I've been keeping you waiting, but now that you know how to get in touch with me on Twitter or Facebook, I'd love to hear from you. Certainly love to find out how you heard about me. But anything that you have, any thoughts or any comments, please reach out, let me know what's going on, and make this a little bit more interactive. As I said, I've been doing a lot of reading last couple of weeks. I finished 3 different books, so we're going to get to those, although I'll probably spend more time with 2 of them. And, it actually was more like 2.5 books. I mean, I read the other book, but really doesn't require a whole lot of discussion. So maybe we'll just get to that first and get it out of the way. A couple episodes ago, I told you about the Joe Nesbo book that I'd read, the Red Breast, how much I'd enjoyed it. I was in between books. I was waiting for a book to come out, and so I figured I might as well pick up the next in the line of the series of the Harry Hooley character, the Norwegian police officer. And this one is the 4th book in the series, but only the 2nd book that they've actually translated into the English. And this one's called Nemesis. And I'm not going to get into a whole long discussion about what was wrong with it. I'm going to tell you it was awful. I'm going to tell you that it had a promising premise. It involved bank robberies, murder that took place at a bank robbery. At the same time, it involved a murder of a former girlfriend of our star hero, of Harry Hooley's. And the book jacket, or at least the description on Amazon.com, gave some reason to think that the two instances were related, that this bank robbery and the supposed suicide but eventual discovered murder of Harry's former girlfriend were somehow related. Spoiler alert, they really weren't. And that was where the disappointments really started. Just to give you a little bit of background, the book starts with Harry watching a closed-circuit television video of a bank robbery in which the bank robber has a gun to the head of a teller and basically shoots the teller in the head after the money has been retrieved from the safe. And then he escapes, and there's a task force created to identify the bank robber. And Harry is brought onto the task force because of his experience and expertise in tracking murderers, although he, of course, butts heads with the chief or the head of the task force, who is treating this like any other type of a random robbery. At the same time, while Harry's girlfriend and his girlfriend's son are in Russia dealing with a custody hearing that we learned a little bit more about in the previous book, Harry reconnects with an old flame, and somehow or other ends up going back to her house and sleeping with her, and gets drugged somewhere during the night and stumbles home, finds out the next morning that his former lover had been killed. Although the police initially believe that it's a suicide, Harry doesn't seem to set well with him, so he starts to track it down a little bit and discovers that it was in fact a murder. Of course, Harry doesn't tell anybody that he was involved with the woman, knows the woman, or was even there the night that she was killed, and tries to conduct the investigation on his own. The interesting thing is there is a little bit of a connection between the ex-girlfriend's murder and the bank robbery, and that is that the ex-girlfriend was a gypsy, and her uncle is actually serving time in jail because he was the foremost bank robber in all of Norway. And so Harry, because he is on this task force for the bank robbery, seeks out the assistance of this bank robber who's in jail. So there is a connection, the connection to the two instances being this character who's in jail. His name, by the way, is Raskol, R-A-S-K-O-L. You can't help but draw some sort of a connection between this character of Raskol and Raskolnikov from the Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Crime and Punishment, by the way, a novel that I've picked up twice and got through about five pages and put down twice. Even though it seems like it would be a good book, and I certainly had an interest in reading it, after a couple of pages, for some reason or other, I had to put it down twice. Nevertheless, there is, every time you see this character's name come up on the pages, you can't help but thinking of Crime and Punishment. But unfortunately, there's a belief that there's going to be a tying of these two instances, that there's this murderer connected with the bank robbery, and then the ultimately discovered murder of Harry's former paramour. And you think that there's a connection, that the fact that Harry's involved in both of those investigations will lead to the discovery that they're connected through Harry in some way. And the book dragged, very little action, and the payoff was so poor that it really doesn't bear going into any further detail. It was so disappointing, and it really backed me off of the Harry Hooley character for the time being. I do have the next book in the series called The Devil's Star. Again, based on the book jacket or his description as it is on Amazon, it seems like it would be exciting. It seems like it's going to be a page-turner, but I'm really not that interested right now. This one really, really put me off the character and really put me off the author, and so it's going to be a while before I go back to it. So I guess I'm just going to have to chalk this one up to yet another in a disappointing line of books that have failed to really excite me over the past few months. Now, that being said, and getting that out of the way, two books that I was really high on, two books I was really excited to hear about, two books I was really, really looking forward to reading, similar types of stories, similar types of genres, and we're going to talk about them right now. The first one is called Murder as a Fine Art by David Morrell. And this was a book that I knew absolutely nothing about. I had not heard of, was not on my radar until 2 days before it came out. And the way that I found out about it was Entertainment Weekly. If you read Entertainment Weekly, you know that in the first few pages of the magazine each week, there's their must list, top 10 things going on that week that you as the entertainment consumer must be aware of. And it's always a blend of movies, television, music, and books, and probably, if there's anything catching their eye, stage. And that particular week, when I got the issue on that Friday, I read to the must list and saw that they were very high on this book, Murder as a Fine Art, coming out the following Tuesday. And they plugged it as being Victorian England murder mystery, the fog and the cobblestones and dark alleyways and a murder terrorizing the city. And as you've been listening to these podcasts, you know that's something that really makes me salivate. So I was excited. And when I was thinking about getting the book, obviously I went to Amazon as soon as I could and ordered it so it would be delivered on that Tuesday. One of the things I was actually kind of disappointed about before I'd even started the book was that it wasn't longer. As soon as I saw the must list and saw that, I went to Amazon to buy it and also went to see how long it was, keeping my fingers crossed that it was going to be a big 500 or 600 page book, because I really wanted to sink my teeth into something that was going to be of that type of genre. And so I was a little disappointed when I saw it was only 350 pages or so. Now, it's not quantity, it's quality, I understand that, but I really had been looking for something that seemed to fit these exact parameters, or this book seemed to fit exactly what I was looking for. So the hope that it would be something that I could really wrap my arms around was initially off-putting when I found out that it wasn't quite going to be that long. But nevertheless, I was incredibly excited to read the book. As you may know, David Morrell is the creator, probably one of the most famous characters in all of fiction and all of entertainment. He created the character of John Rambo. John Rambo from The First Blood, from Rambo First Blood Part 2, or Rambo 2 First Blood, I'm not sure what it's called, then Rambo 3, then John Rambo, or whatever the last Rambo was called. David Morrell created that character in the books first, and they were, of course, immortalized in the films with Sylvester Stallone. I'd never read a David Morrell book. I'd always viewed David Morrell as an author who wrote military, who wrote war books, Vietnam maybe, Definitely books that involved a lot of gunplay and mercenaries, things like that. So I was never real excited about a Dave Morrell book and never picked one up. I think I tried to read Rambo First Blood Part 2 at one point, but I didn't really get very far. So the idea that David Morrell would create a book like this was a little bit surprising, not necessarily the genre that I had always envisioned he was known for. But I was certainly excited about it. And the story is basically a murderer in 1854 in London. A murderer is recreating murders that took place right at the beginning of the 19th century. The murders took place in 1811. So this is 43 years later, and a killer is recreating the exact same murders that took place in 1811. Now, what was initially awesome about this book is that the first chapter is the murderer committing the murders in 1854. So it's following him as he is pursuing these nasty, nasty deeds, and it includes the murder of a shopkeeper, his wife, their daughter, infant baby in the baby cradle, lots of blood, lots of slashing, a quite gruesome murder. And you automatically get taken in by the ferocity of the killings, but also about the mystery and the horror of this murderer. And so right there, you already feel the darkness kind of enveloping you as you're reading about these murders taking place. From there, the author introduces the investigating team that's going to be investigating the murders, the initial chase. After they get to the scene, believe that the murderer is nearby, and as they, as one of them, Inspector Day, I believe it is, tries to track him through some of the windy neighborhood streets around the location of the murder. Obviously, he proves unsuccessful. But within the next couple chapters after that, there's introduced the character of Thomas De Quincey. And Thomas De Quincey is actually a real character, a real person who existed right around that period of time. And this blending of the real with the fictional is really a talent that not a lot of people have. Certainly, I've read authors like Matthew Pearl, who's blended that incredibly well, as well as a couple other authors I can't think of offhand right now, who have been real successful at blending the real with the fictional. Thomas De Quincey, by the way, was a famous author during this period of time. And the reason why he figures into the story so prominently is because right after the murders of 1811, De Quincey wrote a book that chronicled those murders. And he basically took it step by step of how the murders were committed in 1811. The way that I pictured it, even though I never read this book, was like Truman Capote chronicling the murders in Cold Blood. And so he is incredibly descriptive about how the murders were committed in 1811, that the police immediately suspect him as the culprit, as the murderer, because he so intimately knew all the details of how the murders were committed, and thus had the inside scoop on how to commit them again in 1854. What we find out, and the inspectors eventually find out, is that De Quincey, it's just not possible that he could have committed these murders. Not only the fact is he incredibly old and frail and weak and certainly not strong enough to have committed this many murders in one fell swoop, but he's also a well-known opium eater, which is a drug addict. And so he is so dependent upon opium that without having his steady supply of opium, he basically is debilitated and unable to move and basically can't function. One of the other reasons why De Quincey was well known was that he had written written a book, sort of like an autobiography or a memoir, called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And it basically chronicled all of his devolvement into the land of opium and the way that it affected him. Certainly some of the characters in the book actually believed that De Quincey was glamorizing his opium addiction, when in fact that's not what he was doing. He was trying to basically make it a cautionary tale to anybody who was interested in opium of its effects. And ultimately the murderer, the villain as he's identified, he blames a lot of his the modus for his murders based on De Quincey's glamorizing opium. And I'm not going to get into the details of why the murderer did what he did, but he blames a lot of the opium trade, a lot of the drug trade, which certainly could be the same story as of today, but he blames a lot of that, the success of the drug trade, on De Quincey and his glamorizing the effects of opium as a way of enticing people to try it and thus become addicted to it. One of the things that I found was really exceptional about this book was that not every chapter, but quite a few of the chapters had introductions that were of historical note, whether they were definitive or explanations of where certain terms or phraseology came from, such as why the area in London is called Pall Mall or why the area is called Piccadilly Circus. And it really did an exceptional job of placing the reader right there in 1854 London, so that you understood where these geographical locations came from. You understood that the clothing that the people wore in 1854, that they wore petticoats, where the bloomers came from, the name of the, why they're called bloomers, and why certain people were wearing bloomers. In fact, Thomas de Quincey's daughter, who also assists during the investigations, was somewhat of a forward-thinking woman, and she was constantly criticized for her dress, for the way that she spoke, and also for her lack of apparent sensitivity to some of the more gruesome aspects of the murder. In a lot of instances, the men would be talking and they'd be discussing the murder, they'd be discussing some of the gruesome aspects of it, and they would look to her to leave the room or bat an eyelash as being, taken aback or particularly upset by the details, and she seemed to be fairly strong about it. Definitely a forward-thinking woman, especially for 1854. One of the things that I think was a drawback from the book is that other than a couple of chapters here and there, there are four main investigators. There's De Quincey and his daughter, and then there's Inspector Day and the Constable Becker. Now, I have to apologize. I've been going on for 17 minutes. I've been using the wrong damn name. It's not Inspector Day. It's Inspector Ryan. Inspector Ryan and Constable Becker. The reason why I got it confused is because of the other book I read. It's very similar in genre. And that one involved Inspector Day. So I apologize. And it's easy to, after you read them a few times, or you haven't read these for a while. It's been a couple weeks, and to get them confused. So it's Inspector Ryan and Constable Becker. Thomas de Quincey and his daughter, Elizabeth. Crap, not Elizabeth, Emily. Oh, okay, we got it? All right, I think we got it straight. Anyways, as I was saying, one of the drawbacks that I found about this book is that there's these four main characters who, for the last half of the book, or even the last two-thirds of the book, once the investigation really gets moving and they've ruled out de Quincey as the potential suspect, the four characters pretty much travel all together and investigate all together. There are a couple of isolated incidents in which they're not all together, but this seems to slow down the pacing a little bit, and I'll get to a different way to structure the story when I talk about the other book I read, but it definitely slows down the pacing when all of your characters are moving together in a clump. And so in this instance, there was a couple of situations where De Quincey went off on his own, such as when he went and visited the homeless people and got them to assist him with a certain task, kind of a setup for the murderer. But other than that, they all kind of moved together, and it really slowed things down. One of the other things that I found was a little bit disconcerting about the story was that the identity of the killer was not particularly exciting. His motives for committing the murders were not particularly compulsive. And so there wasn't a great, aha, wow, that's so exciting conclusion to the story when the murderer was identified. And I think we actually learned who the murderer was right around the two-thirds mark of the story. So it really didn't have a big reveal. And even though we didn't quite yet know his motives, when we did learn what his motives were, they weren't particularly powerful. I'd hoped for something a little bit more scary and a little bit more a little bit more dark about his motives. One of the other things is that there's two sets of murders, and then it seems like the murders just stopped. Because they were mimicking the murders of 1811, there was a murder, or there was a one set of murders, and then there was an additional set of murders about 10 days later. And so as the 1854 murders were taking place, you had the initial set of murders, and then you had another set of murders about a week after that, and then there wasn't really anything else. So I had hoped that there would be more. There wasn't really that sense of pending doom, that if they didn't find out what was going to happen, if they didn't find out who the murderer was within a certain time frame, then more people would be killed. There was, but it was more tied to kind of a tangential storyline, not necessarily tied to the initial 1811 murders. And so that was a little bit disappointing. It kind of slowed things down a little bit. I did find myself struggling at times to finish chapters. Some of the chapters were pretty long. And so it kind of had its ups and downs as far as its intensity levels. Just by comparison, there was a book I read last year sometime called Blood Atonement by Dan Waddell. And this book had a similar type of a theme. It was a murderer who was committing murders, and they were related to incidents that took place hundreds of years earlier. And the connection was that the murderer was a relative of a convicted murderer from a couple centuries earlier, and he believed that his ancestor had been executed unfairly, that he didn't actually commit the murders that he was tried for and then hanged for. And so he was basically getting his revenge by taking out all the people's, the ancestors or the descendants of all the people who were involved in the initial trial and execution of his ancestor. So the judge had descendants a couple generations later, and this guy was killing the judge's descendant. He was killing the prosecuting attorney's descendant. He killed some of the jurors' descendants. So there was a connection to the events that had taken place in the previous however many, and I don't remember if it was centuries earlier or generations earlier. I just don't remember. But so there was a connection. And in this instance, I had hoped that there would be a similar type of connection. Even though I'd read a book just like that, I'd hoped that there were a connection to that as well. There was. The murderer was basically the son, the illegitimate son of the person who committed the murders in 1811. But again, his motives for doing so were a little bit unappetizing. They just weren't satisfying. And from that standpoint, it did bring the book down a little bit. I gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. This is a book, though, that it's been a couple weeks since I read it. As you can tell, I get the characters' names wrong, for God's sakes. It's been a couple weeks since I read it, and actually, it's kind of settled on me a little bit. It's easier in hindsight to overlook some of the shortcomings of the story and really highlight some of the more successful aspects of it. The cobblestone alleyways and the fog, which plays an incredible role, because it seems like the fog is always rolling in and getting thick and the characters can't see more than a couple feet in front of them. It certainly heightened the terror and the suspense of the book. The historical accuracy was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, there's a part of the book where they discuss, or the author discusses, the evolution of Madame Tussauds' wax museum that's located there on Bond Street in London. And I've been to Madame Tussauds before. I've been to the Chamber of Horrors, which is discussed as well in the book, and where it came from. And just a really cool passage about the evolution of Madame Tussauds, and loving London the way I do, and being able to picture it, picturing the Chamber of Horrors. Interestingly enough, there was in 1854, apparently, there was an exhibit in the Chamber of Horrors that depicted the 1811 murders. So just a really cool historical analysis of the time, and really a testament to the amount of investigation and research that David Morrell did. And in fact, I think that in the conclusion of the book, there's an afterword in which he basically says that for 2 years he lived in 1854 London, and really wanted to bring the reader into 1854 and tried to make it as historically accurate as he could. And I think he really succeeded on that. So my 3.5 stars, I think I'm actually going to bump it up to 4. It really has settled in with me. And the drawback, the motive for the murders was really not quite settling with me. There was an interesting scene somewhere during the middle of the book that does not seem to have much of a relation to the rest of the story. I'm hoping that this is really the start of a new series of books, because these are characters that I got to like. Not necessarily Thomas De Quincey so much as Inspector Ryan and Constable Becker. And it's something that I noticed in the other books that I've liked. One of them I'm going to talk about right after we talk about this one. The other that I've talked about before, the James McCreet books, which also has an inspector and a constable. And I think that perhaps that's just the way it was done back then, but I really tend to enjoy it because you've got the inspector who's kind of the wizened veteran, who's got the experience in investigating murders, and then you have the constable who is like a sidekick, but seems to be a sidekick who's ready to run through walls, always has the drive and the ambition to become an inspector, wants to learn, really focuses on what the inspector's doing, pays attention, but also is willing to shoulder the burden of taking the hit and inevitably ends up bleeding and near death, but somehow manages to come to the rescue of the inspector and is the brawn with the inspector's brains. So I really like those characters. Incidentally, I read another book last year sometime. I think it was called Some Danger Involved by an author named Will Thomas, I think it was. And I was really expecting great things from it. It took place in a similar time in London, right around the, I don't remember, 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, something around that time period, right around that Victorian era. And it involved an inspector, a private inspector, who was looking for a new sidekick. And he had posted an advertisement in the newspaper looking for this new sidekick. And he termed it that whoever it was who got the job could anticipate that there would be some danger involved. And it was similar to like a Sherlock Holmes. He was a Sherlock Holmes looking for his Dr. Watson, and just a terrifically, terrifically disappointing book. So when I see it done well, it's really something that I look forward to reading more of. So that was Murder as a Fine Art. If you've seen the book in the bookstore, you'll notice it's a brownish cover with a black figure, long coat, black top hat, with his back to the reader. But that's kind of the that's kind of what you expect when you'll see any of these books that are in the genre of Victorian era crime fiction, the Jack the Ripper in Shadow type of a thing. And interestingly enough, the other book that we're going to talk about also has the same type of a figure on its cover. This one's called The Black Country by Alex Grecian, Grecian. And it as well has a shadow of a Jack the Ripper type character with the top hat and the long black coat. Although this one also has, it has this character in a smaller form walking on the cobblestone streets of some sort of a town, and there's the fog that's rolling in, and a one solitary street light kind of casting shadows in the foreground, and making the lone figure on the book much more menacing. So this is The Black Country by Alex Grecian. This was the follow-up to one of my top 5 books of last year. In fact, I think it was number 2, called The Yard. It was a book that I found on Amazon and saw that it was coming out within the next week or two, and hurriedly ordered it, and it came the day it came out, and I absolutely devoured it. It was a fantastic, fantastic book involving Inspector Day and his constable, Hammersmith. That was it, Hammersmith. And interestingly, in The Yard, what they also did was they included the help of a physician, basically a medical examiner, and his name was Dr. Kingsley. And in the first book, it took place right there in London, right after the Jack the Ripper killings had taken place. They seem to have stopped, and Scotland Yard forms this this murder squad, basically to address any murders that seem to be now running rampant throughout London after the Jack the Ripper killings. And what I loved about that first book, The Yard, and what, again, came out so well in this book, The Black Country, is the pacing. The pacing is absolutely relentless. And the way that the pacing of this book so far surpasses the pacing of Murders of Fine Art is it's got the same number of characters. It's got these multiple characters. It's got Inspector Day. It's got Hammersmith. It's got Dr. Kingsley. It has another character who is a little bit of a shady character. We're not sure whether he's a good guy or bad guy or what his participation is here. But his name is Calvin Campbell, and we're not sure who he is. There's a local constable. His name's Constable Grimes, and I'll tell you why there's a local constable, because this story doesn't take place in London. It actually takes place in... It takes place in the British Midlands, called the Black Country, thus the name of the book. And there's also a couple of other characters that figure prominently, as well as the killer himself, or the criminal. We're not sure there's any murders yet. But the criminal himself also makes an appearance in this book and shows up every so often. So with this number of characters, different from Murders of Fine Art, where the main characters seem to all travel together, in this book, Alex Grecian finds a way to separate them all. And they all pretty much go off on their own direction to investigate the crime that they believe has taken place in this small town. And what makes that such an effective tool is every chapter is a different character. And of course, at the end of each chapter, there's a cliffhanger. Something happens to the character, and then you've got to wait three chapters to find out what happened. And that really not only amps up the suspense, but keeps the pages turning so quickly because you can't wait to find out what happens next. And then just when you think you've figured out what's going on, or you've gotten to a lull in the story, then the villain, the bad guy, he makes an appearance. And he shows up, and you know it's him because the typeface for his writing is always in italics. And in fact, it tracks exactly what he's doing. So while all this is going on, while Day and Hammersmith and Kingsley and Grimes and Campbell, and there's kids involved, and all these other, you know, minor characters, while all this stuff is going on and they're going through their own investigations, you know, a chapter at a time, then you've got the bad guy who shows up and also puts in his two cents. And it absolutely makes the book fly by. The pages just leap, you know, one after the other. And it is incredibly effective. Now, the first thing that I got to say about the book is the author's name on the cover needs to be bigger. I mean, he's got to take some more pride in this book. I'm sure it's not an issue of pride, but they really need to beef up the size of his name because there's a lot of empty space or space where his name could be bigger. So, Alex, if you're listening, get a bigger typeface next time. It's got to be larger. The other part is the name of the book is The Black Country. It doesn't really tell a whole lot about the book, and it doesn't really draw the reader in, just like The Yard, as the name of the first book, didn't really draw the reader in just by the name of it. But I mean, those are really ticky-tacky, minimal types of things, because the book really is a fantastic entry. And this dividing up of the characters, it really takes place about halfway through the story, which makes sense because it needs to set up the story. So the story is that Day and Hammersmith come from London. On the train, and they come to this small town, the British Midlands, and they're met at the train station by Constable Grimes, and they've been sent for, their murder squad has been, this group, the two of them have been sent from the murder squad to this town to investigate the disappearance of a child and two adults, and the belief that potentially there's been a murder, or all three of them have been murdered. So the first half of the book is really setting that up. It's the two detective and the constable coming and learning who the characters are, learning a little bit of the lore of the town, because there's all these little secrets and there's little myths and beliefs about the that have gone through the town, and so they have to acclimate themselves to the local lore, so to speak, of the people and the mysteries that surround this town. Once Dr. Kingsley gets there the next day, then the real suspense starts, and the real fast pace starts, because that's when the characters divide up and go on different paths in order to determine what the whether there's been a crime committed, try and find the missing people, try and find if there's been a murder, all of that type of stuff. Now, one of the things that I will comment about the book that I found was a little bit a little bit surprising and disappointing about the story is that you find out later that the bad guy, the character who is talking to us in italics, he is actually not related to the murders or the missing child and the two adults. He's not really related to them. So he is, but tangentially, he doesn't have anything to do with the reason why Day and Hammersmith and Kingsley are there. So I had hoped that there would have been a little bit more tying in of that entire storyline together. It's more of a coincidence that the italicized character and Day and Hammersmith seem to converge on the Black Country at the same time. But it's not really that huge of a deal. The characters are incredibly believable. The suspense is palpable. And it seems like everyone has a secret, which is really effective because, like I said, if a character says that they have a secret but they don't reveal the secret at the end of the chapter, then you got to read further and you really can't put the book down. And I found myself at 20 after 11, 11:30, just really, really disappointed that I had to go to bed and I couldn't read a couple more chapters to really find out what was going on. So I don't want to give any more about this story away because I really want to encourage you to read it and also pick up the first book, The Yard. I liked The Yard better because of one reason, because that one took place in London. And I love the city of London, and I love the cobblestone streets and the fog and all the stuff that David Morrell did such a great job of with Murder is a Fine Art. I really like the familiarity that I have with London. And so the fact that The Yard took place there, it felt so much more appetizing to me. This one, The Black Country, I tell you, I immediately thought when I saw that it took place in the British Midlands, I thought about the Sherlock Holmes book, Hound of the Baskervilles, which took place out on the moors, I think it was, or at Dartmoor. And that was not in London, where so many of Sherlock Holmes's stories and books took place. This one took place outside of London. And I felt like, as I was reading Hound of Baskervilles, that the story slowed down because it was in an area which I was not familiar. And so I was a little bit concerned that this one as well would be a slower paced book because I would not be able to visualize, or I was not as well familiar with the British Midlands as I was with London. That's really the only complaint I have about the book, and that's not really a complaint other than it's the reason why I like The Yard slightly better than I enjoyed this book. Because The Yard, it had the sights and the smells and the sounds of London in the 1890s, and I don't really have anything to compare that with as far as the British Midlands of 1890s. But, I mean, that's little stuff. That really doesn't mean a whole lot. But this one's definitely going up on the top of the list so far for this year. And I guess the last disappointment I have is I got to wait another year until he comes out with another book. But this is definitely two books into the series. And I think this is one of the series that's now going to become my favorite. And Alex Grecian is going to really rank up there with Michael Connelly, Jonathan Kellerman, Jonathan Kellerman, Michael Connelly, Lee Child as the books that I'm going to be pre-ordering on Amazon.com so I get it as soon as possible. Oh, and a little thing about this, that I pre-ordered this one, and I don't know if you're aware, new books come out on Tuesdays, but mine came out I got mine the Monday before. disappointment, of course, that I couldn't start that book immediately because I was still reading the damn Joe Nesbo book. After I finished Murders of Fine Art, I knew that The Black Country was coming, and I had 4 days or so in between books, in between when I finished the Morel book and when I knew that the Grecian book would come, so I was trying to find something to fill the time. Again, looked at my shelves, couldn't find anything that I really wanted to read or knew that I'd be able to put, you know, get through. And so I figured the Joe Nesbo book would be a great stopgap. And yeah, that was just an epic fail, quite a bit of a backfire. So so that's that for the three books that I've read the last couple of weeks. I'm actually about 80 pages. Yeah, I got about 80 pages left in the most recently child book, A Wanted Man, Jack Reacher Returns. This is in paperback. The hardcover of this one came out last year sometime, and I really resisted buying it in hardcover because I knew how quickly I was going to read it. And I had read all the other books in paperback, and I'm kind of a guy for continuity, and I like how the books all line up on the bookshelf. Call me crazy, but from an aesthetic standpoint, I like the way they look. And since I'd had all of the previous, I think 16 books in paperback lined up on my bookshelf, I figured I could wait a few more months for the latest Jack Reacher to come out in paperback so I could keep the continuity straight. But Jack Reacher is back, and this one is so far just really, really awesome. And it's like Jack Reacher is kind of like a warm blanket when you've gone through the doldrums of books that have just not been satisfying. You get to wrap yourself up in a Jack Reacher novel, and it's just comforting and it's just soothing. And this book, one disappointment, I know I've said that word a lot, disappointments, but one disappointment about this book. When I picked it up at the bookstore and I flipped to the back, it was like 650 pages or something like 600 pages, something like that. And I was just excited. I'm like, oh, yes, you know, this is the book. It's roll up your sleeves and really get, you know, entrench yourself in the experience of another Jack Reacher book. And then as I'm flipping through the book, I see that it's really 530 pages, and it's like another 70 pages of excess stuff. There's a short story, and there's an excerpt from the next book, and of course it's a short story that I've already read. And I don't know about you, but I never, ever, ever, ever read the previews of upcoming books. I never read them. It's a waste of time to me. I mean, what's the point of reading three chapters of a book that I'm not going to be able to read for another 6 or 8 months? I'm going to read the book anyways. You don't need to entice me or try and draw me in with the prospect of a new book by getting me to read the first three chapters and get so hooked that I can't wait to buy the next book. I'm going to buy the next book. So I don't see why I'm going to punish myself or torture myself by reading a couple of chapters of a preview book that's not going to come out for 6 months. So disappointed, upset, kind of sad that the book wasn't going to be longer. I'm not afraid of big books. I'm afraid of big books that are boring. I'm afraid of big books that are slow. But a Jack Reacher, anything but. And, you know, I can burn through 100, 150 pages in a night because the books just, the pages just fly by. And it's actually been a Jack Reacher weekend because not only am I reading that one, but we also got a Netflix The Jack Reacher movie with Tom Cruise. So here's what I'm going to do, a preview for next time. Next time, it's going to be devoted to Jack Reacher. I'm going to talk about the latest book, A Wanted Man. I'm going to talk about the movie. I'm going to talk about the previous 16 books. I'm not going to go through each one, and I'm not going to go through each one story-wise. I'm not going to give you the synopsis of each one, but I'm going to pick out the ones that I liked, the ones I didn't like, give you a little bit of info on Jack Reacher, some of my thoughts on it. So that's going to be a Jack Reacher episode. But I think that's about it for right now. This has been Book Therapy Episode 10. Again, find me on Twitter, Book Therapy 13. Facebook at Book Therapy, Goodreads, you can still find me, Rob Cohen, and my blog, web, Rob Cohen 13, and thank you for letting me lie on your couch.